You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the must not take yourself too seriously and... 6-1 since that matters. And what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble. With exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. No one compliments you when their paycheck's correct. But make one mistake and you risk alienating your entire workforce. Kronos makes sure your payroll is done right the first time, from punch to paycheck. With embedded checklists and simplified workflows, Kronos is your single source of truth. With Kronos, you get HR, payroll, talent, and timekeeping in one unified system. All with a proven implementation approach and simplified, transparent pricing. Learn more at kronos.com/payroll. Kronos, workforce innovation that works. And now, enjoy the show. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. One day, Lori was a therapist helping patients in her Los Angeles practice. The next day, a crisis caused her world to come crashing down. Enter Wendell, the quirky but seasoned therapist in whose office she suddenly landed. With his balding head, cardigan, and khakis, he seemed to have come straight out of Therapist Central casting. Yet he turned out to be anything but. I know, it all sounds like the plot of a TV sitcom, so it's probably not surprising that Eva Longoria is developing that story as a series for ABC. But it's actually based on the real-life experience of therapist Lori Gottlieb, which she writes about in her new book titled Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, A Therapist, Her Therapist, and Our Lives Revealed. And today, Lori Gottlieb comes on the podcast to talk about what it was like to switch roles and be the patient on the couch, the event that led her to seek help, the underlying issues that came to surface, and the unusual methods employed by her own psychotherapist. She discusses some of her favorite patients, anonymously of course, including the insufferable Hollywood producer who she initially described as a grade-A asshole, the newlywed diagnosed with terminal cancer, and the one patient who she says was like looking in a mirror. Lori offers some ideas for how to address the larger mental health crisis in America and begin to destigmatize mental health problems, and she weighs in on the ongoing debate among those in her profession over the Goldwater Rule and diagnosing politicians from afar. Plus, Lori reveals whether she's ever dozed off on a patient, why her own therapist once kicked her in session, and what her colleagues think about her pulling back the curtain on psychotherapy. Coming up with Lori Gottlieb in just a moment. Lori Gottlieb is a psychotherapist and New York Times best-selling author who writes The Atlantic Weekly's Dear Therapist Advice column. A contributing editor for The Atlantic, she also writes for The New York Times and appears as a frequent expert on relationships, parenting, and hot-button mental health topics in the media, such as The Today Show, Good Morning America, CBS This Morning, CNN, and NPR. Now she reveals what it's like to be a psychotherapist and a patient in her new book, Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, A Therapist, Her Therapist, and Our Lives Revealed. Lori Gottlieb, welcome to the podcast.
Happy to be here.
I have to ask, is it weird doing interviews like this? You're usually the one asking questions, aren't you? So is it awkward to be on the other side of that?
Right. No, it's really not. I was a journalist before I was a I was a therapist.
No kidding.
So I'm used to the question and answer format.
Okay. Well, I enjoyed your book, and in it you say your best credential as a therapist is the fact that you are, quote, a card-carrying member of the human race. Does that mean anyone can do what you do?
It means that, of course, we need our training and our credentials and everything that we needed to do to learn how to do this profession. But I think that what's most significant in terms of what actually helps people is that we are card-carrying members of the human race. We know what it's like to be a person in the world. And I think that if you are the expert up on high, you're going to miss what really happens in the therapy room, which is really a very human connection.
Mm-hmm. Precisely because you are only human, I have to ask, have you ever fallen asleep on a patient, or how do you keep from daydreaming?
You know, people always ask that question. And before I became a therapist, I had the same questions.
Yeah.
You know, am I boring this person, or do they want to fall asleep? Are they thinking, oh no, here she goes again with that story?
Yeah.
But I think that when you're in the room with somebody, you're not only listening to the story that they're telling you, but so much else is going on. You're watching their body language.
Right.
You're listening for all kinds of things that they might not be saying. You're kind of looking for, you know, the music under the lyrics.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever have any patients who are just insufferable, or anyone maybe that you've said no to, said, I can't treat you, or I don't want to treat you because it takes too much of a toll on me?
Well, it's interesting because study after study shows that the most important factor in the success of someone's therapy mm-hmm. is the relationship you have with your therapist.
Okay.
And so, you know, if somebody comes in for a consultation and it's not the right match, mm-hmm. either I'm not their cup of tea, or they are dealing with something that I don't think I would be the best person to help them with that, then I would refer them out.
Really?
Yeah. I think that the people that therapists see are the people that they really know that they can help.
And in my imagination, I tend to think that the life of a therapist is sort of lonely, other than the times when you're in a room with a patient. There's no one around. It's just the therapist. But you say that you actually have a group of therapists that you hang out with and others who you share your office suite with, and it's actually pretty social. What goes on? Do you guys exchange notes on your cases? Do you gossip? What happens in there?
So you're talking about two things. One is that I work in a suite of therapists, and we very much have to have our own lives.
Mm-hmm.
You need that break. You'll burn out if you don't. And so, you know, we see each other in the kitchen in our suite between patients. We don't talk about our patients so much. We talk about our own lives.
Okay.
But sometimes we'll do a quick consult between sessions. We have to be very careful about confidentiality.
Sure.
So if there's something that we're stuck with, we might ask somebody about it, but we'd be very careful with the confidentiality aspect. Mm-hmm. But most therapists do belong to consultation groups, which is a group of therapists who meet once a week, and they do discuss their cases, again, confidentially. And it's really helpful. But these groups also can tend to be very social. You know, with ours, we would do it on Friday afternoons, and we'd have wine and cheese and crackers. And
okay, that sounds fun.
Because we really need to, you know, we call it self-care. We need to really make sure that we're taking care of ourselves too. But you're right. It is very much something that you do alone in a room, and you do need other colleagues to talk to.
Do you find that helps you getting other opinions on your cases?
Very much so. I think that, you know, in any other job, you could say to your coworker, like, hey, what do you think about this? Or look at my PowerPoint, or, you know,
right? Exactly.
You can get feedback. Yeah. And nobody's there to give you feedback. And not only feedback on what you could do better, but nobody's there to say, like, hey, that thing that you said, that was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no one's there to even give you positive feedback on a job well done.
Yeah.
So you're kind of in a bubble. And the consultation group, I think, fills in that gap somewhat.
Well, I have to wonder, how have your colleagues at work reacted to the book? I know it's not out yet, but has there been any blowback or worries that you're somehow demystifying the process too much?
Well, first of all, I think people want the process demystified. Mm-hmm. I think that more people who would benefit from therapy would make that call if they would read this book and say, oh, that's what therapy is actually like.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, in terms of the reaction of my colleagues, when I told people who are not therapists that I was writing this book about me in therapy and my patients in therapy, you know, they were really interested in it. But when I told my colleagues, they said, wait, you're doing what? You're writing about yourself in therapy? What? Yeah. Why would you do that?
And it's interesting because we do confer a certain Wizard of Oz-like aura on your profession, as if you almost instinctually have all the answers and can solve everyone's problems. Do you think that people put too many expectations on psychotherapy and on psychotherapists?
I think that a lot of times people wait so long to come in. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like if you were having chest pain, you wouldn't wait until you had a heart attack before you went to your doctor. Most of us would, you know, most of us would say, I want to get that checked out. But a lot of us, we feel like, I talk about in the book this hierarchy of pain, that there isn't a hierarchy of pain. Pain is pain. But I think a lot of us feel like, well, I'm not in the middle of a major depressive disorder, you know, episode. Mm-hmm. So I, you know, and my life is pretty good, and what do I have to complain about? So I don't really, you know, that would be embarrassing to go to a therapist. They would look at me and send me home.
Mm-hmm.
But I think if you're struggling with something, therapy offers something that talking to your friends doesn't, mm-hmm. which is holding up the mirror and saying, here's a pattern that you're in. Here are the ways that you might be shooting yourself in the foot in a lot of different areas in your life. Our friends tend to say, you know, yeah, you're right. Or, you know, they'll support our side. And we don't really get that mirror.
I'm interested in this idea that you talk about of the hierarchy of pain and how people think that, you know, maybe their problems aren't worthy of a psychotherapist's attention or don't rise to that level. But it seems to me that, you know, if you go in and talk about the smaller problems, and that's preventative maintenance for when you do have big problems.
Right. And I think that we give short shrift to our emotional health, mm-hmm. that we pay a lot more attention to our physical health.
Yeah.
And so many times, I think with feelings, people will pretend they're not there. Or people, when they do come in, they're maybe in the throes of grief or sadness or anxiety, and they basically say to me, in not so many words, help me not to feel. And what I tell people is you can't tamp down one set of feelings without tamping down all of your feelings. If you're going to mute the pain, you're also going to mute the joy.
You yourself went to see a therapist when you had some issues that you needed to deal with. You want to talk a little bit about the event in your life that precipitated that?
Sure. So I was with somebody, with a boyfriend that I had planned to get married to, and that was our plan together. And one night he tells me that he has decided that he can't live with a kid under his roof for the next 10 years, that kid being my 8-year-old. And this came as a complete shock to me. And what I originally wanted out of therapy was, well, first of all, my friend, who was a therapist, I didn't even consider going to therapy. And my friend said, you know, you need to go someplace where you're not being a therapist. Maybe you should talk to someone. And so I did. But I, what I wanted out of this therapist was I wanted him to confirm that my boyfriend was a sociopath. And I'm being, you know,
okay.
I'm exaggerating, but not.
Yeah.
Meaning I wanted him to take my side,
so
the way my friends
him,
did.
Not you.
Right.
Yeah.
And like a good therapist, he wasn't buying my story at mm-hmm. all, which was, yes, this was a shock, but were there clues along the way? Were there things that I was avoiding that I didn't want to see? Because we both were avoiding things because we really did want to be together, but we also had these lifestyle issues between us that were there, you know, that we just weren't talking about.
Did you have any particular criteria for what you were looking for in a therapist?
When you're in crisis, I think that it's a different process. I think mm-hmm. when you're not in crisis and you're looking for a therapist, you might do more research. At that point, I knew that I needed to go talk to somebody. And because I was concerned about how people might react if I asked my I was surrounded by therapists. And
right.
so you have to realize that you can't see someone with whom you consult. You can't
sure.
see someone that you refer to or if they refer to you. You don't want to see anybody that you know just socially. And so it was hard. I was surrounded by therapists. It was like water everywhere, but not a drop to drink. And so I ended up getting a referral through a friend who was a therapist, but I didn't tell her it was for me because I was concerned that people might hesitate about you know, whether they would refer to me or, you know, and it was really interesting because as therapists, we really do everything we can to try to help people not feel stigma around seeking help. And yet I felt stigma around seeking help.
And you referred to a therapist named Wendell. You say that he's straight out of central casting for that job. What is he like?
He was like straight out of Therapist Central casting. He was, you know, the khakis and the cardigan and the sort of stooped posture and the balding head and whatever sort of stereotype we might have.
I think you just described me today. I'm wearing khakis and a sweater.
You have more hair.
Slightly, maybe. Was it difficult to sit down with him and give up that power of being the therapist and just sit there and be the patient?
Oh, absolutely. There are so many times when you feel like you want to do backseat driving, kind of like, you know, that's interesting that he said that. I would have done that differently. But you have to relinquish that control, and you have to just be a person in that room. And it was really enlightening because I did with him all of the things that my patients do with me, meaning
I wanted him
to like me. Yeah. If I saw someone in the waiting room as I was leaving, I'd wonder, you know, oh, does he look forward to her sessions more than mine? You know, all of those things.
Really?
You know, what is he thinking about me, or is he bored?
Yeah, I think at some point you took issue with his policy of charging you for cancellations when you were sick, which is a policy that you yourself have with patients, right?
Right, the 48-hour cancellation policy, right. I have the same cancellation policy.
Yeah, you talk about going in and going out and kind of thinking about the other patients that are either going in or before or after you and whether they're more interesting, what their problems are. I once had a comedian who loves his psychotherapist, but apparently a bunch of other comedians see the same psychotherapist. And so he always goes in and wonders if the other guy's funnier and how he measures up, believe it or not.
Right. The other question he might have is, are they telling the same version of a story that he was involved in, but from a very different perspective that makes them look good and him look bad?
Yeah. Or are they stealing each other's stories the way they steal jokes? I don't know. You never know. So how did your style differ from Wendell's? Wendell has a totally different approach, right?
So at the time that this book takes place, I was a much newer therapist and he was a much more experienced therapist.
Okay.
And one thing that in our training I think we somehow think we need to do is we feel like we need to be kind of the blank slate, the tabula rasa in the room. Hmm. And Wendell just brought himself into the room. I don't mean that he didn't have boundaries, and I don't mean that he wasn't, that he was talking about his personal life, because he certainly didn't. But he was so wholly himself in terms of, he would sing, he would, you know, to make a point. He would
he would
call me on my BS.
Yeah.
He would, you know, he was just completely, it was like a very human encounter.
Uh-huh.
And he really helped me to, you know, sometimes I would leave his office and I would go into my office and I would do or say something very similar to what he had done, but kind of make it my own.
Yeah.
Because he really taught me how to be myself in the room.
Interesting. I mean, I guess that sort of makes sense to me. You know, if he's sort of a relaxed, ebullient personality, singing and being a little bit goofy, maybe even, you know, then that helps you let down your guard. It's very hard to just walk into a room with someone who's basically a stranger and start opening your heart.
Yeah. And he wasn't trying to entertain me, and he wasn't,
okay,
you know, he wasn't being goofy in the service of making me feel comfortable.
Okay.
He was just reacting as a human being, and often he was quite serious. But he was always, you know, I described him as sort of like a cross between a wise elder and a stuffed animal, meaning, you know, he was very, very wise, but also very kind of like warm and comforting, the way a stuffed animal is. So, you know, he could be both. And I think that as therapists, holding those two polarities and offering those to the patient are very important.
Yeah. Didn't you say that at one point he kicked you?
He did.
That's unconventional.
He did. He was trying to get me to see the difference between pain and suffering. And he was saying that you know, everybody suffers, but you don't have to be in so much pain. And if you want to be in pain here, he was joking. But in the service of a point that very much stayed with me, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the way he made his points stayed with me. You know, he'd use metaphor. He'd talk about how I was sort of like a prisoner shaking the bars in jail, but both sides were open and I just couldn't see the ways that I was trapped.
Yeah.
And metaphors like
that's helpful.
They're very helpful. They stay with you.
Well, I wonder, how did putting yourself on the couch with Wendell, how did that make you a better therapist?
I think it gave me more compassion for my patients. Mm-hmm. It made me understand, not intellectually, but viscerally, what their experience is like, mm-hmm. Just how hard it is to be the patient. I think that a lot of people come to therapy and they want the therapist to fix the situation, to make them feel better. And I think that what people come to realize in therapy is that as the patient, you have to do a lot of the work, that we're there to guide you, but you have to do the work itself. Mm-hmm. And I think it gave me a lot more understanding of what that's like and just how hard it is to change and why we're so resistant to change, even though we're there and we're saying, I really want things to change, that sometimes we're our own worst enemy, and all the different ways that we self-sabotage and all the ways that the therapist can see it so clearly, but sometimes you as the patient can't.
I think that you say that seeing a therapist is actually twice as hard as being a therapist, right?
Oh, definitely. I think people are really courageous mm-hmm. when they come in and they do the work. You can come to therapy and not do the work, and a good therapist will tell you, I can't see you anymore. A good therapist will say, I don't think we're doing the work here. And we'll talk about it and we'll try to understand why it's so hard for you to do the work, because it is hard, but we don't want to waste your time. Mm-hmm. And I think that people have this misconception about therapists that you go there and you go every week and you sort of download your problems and then you leave, and it's this very expensive
time and
money investment. But we really, you know, it's the worst business model ever, because our job is to lose patients, right?
Yeah, to get people better.
To get people out. We mm-hmm. want them to be independent. Mm-hmm. We want them to feel better sooner.
Well, I think that there are also those who think somewhat cynically that your job is to keep them there. And, you know, a lot of people probably fear that it's sort of addictive.
Right. I think that if you have a good therapist, they're going to be talking to you about what kind of progress you're making. Mm-hmm. That's going to be a conversation going on all the time. What kind of progress you're making, whether you're meeting your goals, what else is coming up. Unless you're just kind of skating along and the therapist isn't calling you on that, that's probably not the therapist you want to be seeing.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Lori Gottlieb when we come back in just a moment. If there's something interfering with your happiness or preventing you from achieving your goals, BetterHelp Online Counseling can help. BetterHelp offers licensed professional counselors who are specialized in issues such as depression, anxiety, relationships, trauma, anger, family conflicts, LGBT matters, grief, self-esteem, and more. Connect with your professional counselor in a safe and private online environment, and get help at your own time and at your own pace. Anything you share is confidential. And it's so convenient, you can schedule secure video or phone sessions as well as chat and text with your therapist. If for some reason you're not happy with your counselor, though, you can request a new one at any time for no additional charge. Best of all, it's a truly affordable option. Kick-Ass News listeners even get 10% off your first month with the discount code KICK. So why not get started today? Go to betterhelp.com/kick. Then simply fill out a questionnaire to help them assess your needs and get matched with a counselor you'll love. That's betterhelp.com/kick. And now, back to the show. I think somewhere in here you talk about several of your own patients, including one who actually talks about having had that fear, how she had a problem with alcoholism and was afraid of getting addicted to therapy. I don't think it's unusual that there are people who think it can become an addiction or a crutch of sorts. Do you ever see that? Do you ever have to cut someone off at a certain point?
I think the goal of therapy is to get people to learn more about how they relate with the therapist so that mm-hmm. they can transfer those relationships out into the real world.
Yeah.
And so if people feel like we're the only person that they can trust, that they can be open with, that they can be vulnerable with, we really need to work with them to see how they can find that out in the world, because we don't want to be that one person of real human contact for them.
Well, I want to talk about some of these other patients that you profile in the book. What were you looking to show with the particular patients that you selected?
So all of the patients that I selected are very different from each other.
Right.
And that's intentional. You have this sort of narcissistic Hollywood producer who is very entitled and very insulting to me. You have this woman in her 20s who keeps hooking up with the wrong guys, including ultimately somebody in the waiting room. And she just can't seem to understand why she keeps not finding the kind of guys that she wants to find. You have this woman in her 30s who is a newlywed and who is recently diagnosed with cancer. And she's going through this process of fighting for her life and ultimately asking me to be with her until she dies. And you have this person who's about to turn 70 and who has messed up her life in so many ways, messed up her adult children, messed up her marriages, and feels like so much has happened that she doesn't know if she can change it. And she says if things don't get better by her 70th birthday, that she wants to end it.
I want to talk a little bit about each of them. John, the producer, you describe him as a grade A asshole when you first meet him. I can't imagine that a therapist throws around that term lightly when describing their patients. What made him so unbearable? And were there times when it was sort of hard to be his therapist?
Yeah, there were many times. And I think what a supervisor once said to me early in my training that there's something likable about everyone and it's your job to find it. And I thought, well, there's not something likable about everyone. There's got to be people where you just can't find it. But it's true. There really is. And I think you can't get to know somebody deeply without finding something likable in them. And with John, I think that he's going to be the person that the readers just want to hug, that they just are going to love him in the way that I came to love him. But in the beginning, he's unbearable. He tells me that I'm just like his, I'll be like his mistress because he doesn't want his wife to know that he's in therapy. So he gives me this wad of cash and he's like, I'll just come here and unload my problems every week and leave. Ha, just like my hooker. You know? Lovely.
Yeah.
You know, he's incredibly entitled. He basically, you know, says that the reason that he came to me was because he wanted to go to a nobody, you know, people that none of his TV colleagues would know about.
Yeah. No celebrity shrink.
So he'll just come to a nobody like me. You know, he was just, I don't know how much whether he realized he was being insulting, but I do know that he did use those behaviors as a way to keep people out, to protect himself. And there's a big tragedy in his life, which I won't spoil, but once we come to know why he is the way he is and what happened in his life, I think you can't help but understand why he needed so much protection, why he felt like, you know, he felt like everybody in the world were idiots and he was the only person who knew how to navigate his way through life and that really he was the one who was suffering.
Yeah, and it's sort of surprising that he didn't want his wife to know that he was in therapy and would go through all these hoops of this clandestine relationship with his therapist. I would imagine that the wife would probably be thrilled that he was going into therapy the way you describe him.
Right.
Do patients like John fear the stigma or that maybe seeing a therapist is tantamount to validating all the wife's gripes about him or something like that?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I think there's there was his own view of therapy, which I think he had a lot of shame about needing to come to talk to somebody. And I think the other thing was that if he came to therapy, then he felt that his wife would use that as ammunition to say, see, you do have problems. See, all these things that I'm complaining about.
Right. Okay, that's understandable. And now, the other one that you talked to is a 33-year-old university professor who's a newlywed and is diagnosed with cancer, terminal cancer, untreatable. She says that she comes to you precisely because you're not a cancer therapist. I would think that she would want to see someone who was intimately acquainted with her particular struggle. Why didn't she?
Well, when she first came to me, she had been on her honeymoon and she felt something in her breast. And when she came back, she thought maybe she had been pregnant, but it wasn't that. And it was breast cancer. But it was the kind of breast cancer that seemed like it would be very treatable and she would be fine. So she didn't want... She wasn't the person who liked that whole idea of like the pink ribbons and the optimism and all that. She was devastated. And she wanted to just talk to somebody who wasn't, you know, she said like, they have affirmations on their walls. I can't do this. And she just really wanted to get through being a newlywed and having to deal with this treatment that, you know, it wasn't a terminal situation at that point. It was, you have this thing, it's very treatable. The treatment's going to be really hard to get through. It's going to be very uncomfortable. But you're going to get through it.
Mm-hmm.
And so then that happened. She actually did get better. And then 6 months later, on a scan, they found a different cancer that was very aggressive. And she came to me and said, I need you to see me, and I need you to stay with me until I die. Wow. And there were all these, it was a roller coaster. There were all these sort of, you know, maybe she'll live, maybe she won't. This, you know, the miracle experimental treatment seemed to be working. And it was a really profound experience to go through, to accompany her basically on this path to death, especially at such a young age.
Now, people in your profession are always told that they have to maintain a certain amount of detachment. In that particular case, did you worry that maybe you were caring too much or getting too close to your patient?
I worried, first of all, that I didn't have the experience in oncology to know what if I did something wrong? What if I didn't do it well? You know, she'd only get one chance at this, and I didn't want to mess it up for her. But I think what she really responded to was that I was very much like my own therapist, very much myself in the room with her. So, you know, when I started crying, you know, not bawling, but I teared up sometimes when, you know, certainly when I found out that nothing else was going to work. You know, we did all kinds of things that I think were very much just two people in a room, although every decision that I made was intentional. And I think you have to have that balance of being reflective about, you know, is this choice for the benefit of the patient? Because you don't want to be indulgent and do something that's for your benefit. Because this wasn't my journey, it was hers.
You say that you were once told that every therapist has the experience of seeing a patient with whom the similarities are so striking that treating this person is like looking in a mirror. For you, that patient was Charlotte. What was so familiar about her?
Right. So she was basically me 20 years ago.
Okay.
And it was the way that she felt so confused about why her relationships weren't working.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of people in their 20s go through that. But I think there was something that particularly struck me about her family background, even though our family backgrounds were different. There was something about the way that her family background impacted the choices that she would make.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that on the one hand, that made me a good person for her to see. But on the other, I had to be very careful that I was seeing her as a separate person from me.
In your conversations with Wendell, your own therapist, you came to realize that there were similar things, you know, family issues that you had kind of ignored or weren't aware of that played into the rest of your life.
Right. So I think when people come to therapy, they come with what we call a presenting problem, which is, you know, there was a breakup, or I can't sleep, or I'm depressed, or I'm anxious, or my wife died, or, you know, whatever it is, or I lost my job. And sometimes that is what the therapy is about, just that one thing. But sometimes that is just the thing that got them into therapy. And really, there's something that's been brewing beneath the surface that if they can see what that is, then they'll have much more lasting change than if they just deal with that one problem almost like a Band-Aid.
And the fourth patient that you profile in the book is one that you referenced earlier. She's, I think, 70 years old, thought that she had made a mess of her life and it hurt people, was contemplating suicide, thought that she was completely hopeless. I think a lot of us have this idea that a person of a certain age, everything is just baked in with them. You're set in your ways. Real change just ain't going to happen once you reach a certain mark. Does Rita give lie to that assumption, or is it actually harder for older people to change than, say, a 20-something?
It's definitely harder. So much has happened that you can't change. So when I was seeing Charlotte, who was in her 20s, there was so much potential for her to make different choices that could then set the stage for what happened next. With Rita, she had already made those choices, and she had made quite a mess of her children and of her marriages, and she was alone in the world. And it was a very sad situation to look at. And I really wondered, you know, what could change at this late date? But what she showed was that I think she showed up in therapy when she was ready to change. And that's something interesting, too. Wow. I always wonder when somebody comes in, I want to know from them, why this day, this week, this month, did you pick up the phone?
That's a good question.
To call. Because she could have called. She was 69, right? She could have called when she was 50.
Yeah.
She could have called when she was 30 or 70 or 60 or whatever, but she called it 69. And so why now? And I think we call when even if we're not aware of it, part of us is ready for change. Mm-hmm. Part of us is more open to it than we had been before. And so I think that her change seems almost miraculous given what happens to her and how much her life does turn around. But in a way, it's not miraculous because she came in exactly when she was ready. She's like, either I'm going to change my life or I'm not going to live it.
Yeah, better late than never, I guess.
Right.
All four of these people couldn't seem more different on the surface. Did you find certain commonalities beneath that surface?
I did. And I think even with my story, I think their four stories and my story, they're all woven together in this way that even though, you know, the issues that we're presenting with are very different, we're all asking these very core questions about love and loss and desire and need and regret and redemption and hope and change, uncertainty, vulnerability, all of those things. And I think that's what everybody struggles with to some degree.
Interesting. So it's sort of like William Goldman. It all boils down to certain just core issues that have been the issues from the dawn of time, pretty much.
Right. I don't think that the issues change. The way they look might change. The presentation of them might change. But I think at our core, really, it's about how do we love and how can we be loved?
Mm-hmm. Now, there's been a lot of talk about the mental health crisis in America, and it ties into so many other different things happening right now, whether it's the mass shootings or the tone of politics, the opioid epidemic, et cetera. Do you get a sense of this larger mental health catastrophe from your daily work as a therapist, and do you have any solutions?
I do. I think that no matter what people come in with, there's a sense of underlying loneliness, even mm-hmm. if they're surrounded by people. And I think part of that has to do with the ways that we take care of our emotional health have to do with connection. And I think we're so disconnected as a society right now because we think we're connected with our devices. When a supervisor says to me in the book, she says, you know, I tell this story about how she said, the speed of light is outdated. Now everybody moves at the speed of want.
Yeah.
And I think what happens is when you move at the speed of want, you're not really connecting with other people. So we turn to distractions, whether that distraction is opioids, whether that distraction is drinking too much, whether that distraction is eating too much or not eating enough, whether that distraction is the internet, which a colleague called the most effective non-prescription painkiller out there, right? So I think we turn to these distractions to fill in the emptiness that sometimes we feel because we don't have that face-to-face, distraction-free connection that we used to. And I think the therapy room is actually one of the few places now where you sit face-to-face with another person, you hear them breathe, and there are no screens and nothing's disrupting it.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And it's so weird because, you know, the buzzword these days is connected technologies. The technology is all becoming increasingly more connected as humans are becoming less connected. You also write the weekly Dear Therapist column for The Atlantic. That must be, I imagine, doubly difficult because you're working with an email, not an hour of therapy. You can't ask follow-up questions. You can't look a patient in the eye and pay attention to the little micro expressions and visual cues that maybe even reveal more than the words themselves. Do you find that you have to approach the column differently or with extra care than you do when you're with a patient in therapy?
It's a very different experience because you don't know who this person is. And even when people come into therapy, I'm not just listening to the story they're telling, but I'm listening to their flexibility with the story. And with a letter, there's no flexibility. You're just hearing it through their lens. Mm-hmm. I can't get them to see it from the other person's perspective that they might be writing about. And so what I try to do with the column is not just offer advice like don't talk to your mother-in-law, you know, or whatever they want to hear. But it's really about I want you to understand your mother-in-law's perspective. I want to broaden the story for you. So it's a really unique advice column because I'm telling them what a therapist might be thinking if they were to hear this problem in the therapy room.
Okay.
And I'm giving them the benefit of that perspective so that then they have a better chance of making a good choice about how to handle it.
Okay. And that sort of leads me to think about this current debate over the Goldwater Rule. For anyone who doesn't know, it's this code of ethics within your profession by which therapists aren't supposed to diagnose political candidates or really anyone who they haven't actually treated or at least met. Nowadays, some therapists are pointing to President Trump and how supposedly he wears his emotional issues on his sleeve and saying that you don't have to get him in session to know that something's going on there and we need to talk about it. Where do you fall on that issue?
I think that it's one thing to see traits of a personality disorder mm-hmm. or, you know, any kind of mood disorder in somebody. But I think you can't really know somebody unless you really take the time to get to know them. Mm-hmm. So I don't feel comfortable commenting on people that I've never met. And I understand why people do. But it's, you know, I'm very much about either dealing with people face to face in the therapy room or answering letters of people, knowing that we have these limitations when it's just a letter.
And it's interesting because I think maybe a year or so ago when this was a hot topic, someone along the way said, well, the president has the presidential physician. The president should have a psychotherapist, not just Donald Trump, but any president, I would think, with that amount of pressure on you and being, you know, kept in a glass prison, surely it couldn't hurt.
Right. Even Tony Soprano had a therapist, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, I think that the concern is heightened when you're the president, because we're all concerned about talking about things that are very private with this individual who's your therapist. And I think that when you're the president, you know, that's heightened in so many ways.
Yeah. And speaking of Tony Soprano, I have to ask, what do movies and TV shows like The Sopranos, like Lorraine Bracco as the therapist, or like Frasier get wrong about what you do?
I think there are two tropes about therapists in the media or in fictional depictions. Mm-hmm. You know, one is sort of like the brick wall, the person who just says uh-huh, and you know they're not really listening or they're very removed,
right.
And kind of cold.
Yeah.
And I think the other is the therapist who's the hot mess, you know, the one who's like the neurotic hot mess outside of the therapy room, but they're very competent in the therapy room. And neither of which is true for most therapists. I think most therapists, and that's what I'm trying to show in the book, is that most therapists are just like anybody else in the world, mm-hmm. right? So I think that sometimes for dramatic effect, movies and TV will play up, you know, certain aspects of a character, but they're characters.
Yeah.
They're not real therapists.
Yeah. And it sounds like you might get a chance to dispel some of those tropes yourself, because I understand that Maybe You Should Talk to Someone is actually in development for a television series at ABC. Is this a scripted series or a reality show?
It's a scripted series.
Okay.
With Eva Longoria's company.
Oh, wow.
And it's really an adaptation of the book. But what we hope it does is it will take people like the book does into the therapy setting so that they can see people like them.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's, you know, one of the shows that I love on TV right now is This Is Us. And it really takes people into the lives of these characters, and they deal with very real things. And I hope that the TV version of Maybe You Should Talk to Someone does the same thing.
Well, before we go, you know, I could pick your brain for an hour or more. And if you can, without revealing any names or anything, what's the strangest thing you've ever seen in your job?
I think my bar for strange is so high at this point because I think you hear it all.
Yeah.
And so I think that you don't really judge anything that you hear.
Yeah.
And I can't think of anything off the top of my head that strikes me as that strange.
Mm-hmm.
I think you hear the gamut of the human experience.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Well, again, the book is called Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, A Therapist, Her Therapist, and Our Lives Revealed. Lori Gottlieb, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thanks so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks again to Lori Gottlieb for coming on the show. Order her new book, Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, A Therapist, Her Therapist, and Our Lives Revealed, on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. Visit her website at lorigottlieb.com and follow her on Twitter at lorigottlieb1. Whatever struggles you're facing, from depression and anxiety to trauma and grief, BetterHelp can connect you with a professional counselor in a safe and private online environment. It's so convenient, you can schedule secure video or phone sessions, as well as chat or text with your therapist. And anything you share is completely confidential. Best of all, it's a truly affordable option. Kick-Ass News listeners can even get 10% off your first month with the discount code KICK. So why not get started? Simply go to betterhelp.com/kick and fill out a questionnaire to get matched with a counselor you'll love today. Be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on Apple Podcasts if you haven't already. And if you like what you're hearing, then rate and review us while you're there. 5-star reviews are the easiest way for new listeners to find us. Don't forget to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @KickAssNewsPod. And feel free to email me with your thoughts, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. Until next time, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.